welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, military coups have increased over the last year and a half. What is driving this challenge to democracy? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. The recent months have seen several military coups against democratically elected governments. Some examples of this include two different coups in Mali, Haiti, Myanmar, Chad, Guinea, and Sudan. And last month, a military coup overthrew the democratically elected government of President Roch Marc Christian Kabore in Burkina Faso. What is driving this recent spate of military coups? And what does this mean for the global battle for democracy? Our panel today discusses the causes of the coups. They are Jonathan Powell, Associate Professor at the School of Politics, Security, and International Affairs at the University of Central Florida. He is the author of Strong Men and Straw Men, Appraising Post-Coup Political Developments, and the co-author of Global Instances of Coups from 1950 to 2010, A New Data Set. Clayton Tyne is department chair and professor in the political science department at the University of Kentucky. He's the co-author with Jonathan Powell on the Global Instances of Coups article, as well as several others, and the co-author of Democratic versus Authoritarian Coups, The Influence of External Actors on States' Post-Coup Political Trajectories. Fabrice Lahoup is professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. He's the co-author of Breaking Out of the Coup Trap, Political Competition and Military Coups in Latin America and Political Institutions, Instability and Democratic Performance in Latin America, a Research Agenda. And Joseph Wright is professor in the Department of Political Science at Pennsylvania State University and serves as the co-director of the Global and International Studies Program. He's the co-author of How Dictatorships Work and the forthcoming Historical Dictionary of Modern Coup d'Etats. Thank you all for joining us. Jonathan Powell, I'll ask you the first question. There seems to be a recent trend towards military coups. Do you have some insights as to, you know, what might be driving this recent trend?
I think the first thing that's very important to get across is that the places where the coups are occurring, even though the number of coups is certainly strange given tendencies we've seen in the last few decades, they're not occurring in places that would necessarily be surprising. And if you look at the factors that have been most consistently determined to coincide with coups, if you're looking at things like poverty, the existence of civil conflict, the existence of things like terrorist attacks and insurgency more general, and poor economic performance and leaders who are viewed as illegitimate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of these things are what we might refer to as structural conditions in a country that might make them more predisposed or more vulnerable to potentially having a coup. And this coup belt that we've seen across Africa in particular, that it's kind of extraordinary where it's basically a straight line from the Atlantic to the Red Sea. These countries are plagued by these issues. And when you look at the coalescence of all of these factors, you'll find few places in the world where all of these stack up as badly as this specific coup belt, where we've seen coups occurring over the last 18 months or so. So these are general structural conditions, but then we get to the question why over the last year in particular, we've started to see so many. And that's less clear. Some specific events, and we'll get into that a bit later, I'm sure, might have individual triggering effects. But two things that I think are important to get across early. One, the COVID pandemic. You know, that's something that's going to be on everyone's mind, obviously. Even though COVID might not necessarily be something that shows up in the news when you're reading about any one of these particular stories, and COVID might not necessarily be so bad in a particular country that has experienced a coup, but as even the UN Secretary General has pointed out, the pandemic has greatly constrained the ability of the international community to be able to respond to these sorts of events. And it's also undermined their willingness, as for lack of a better way to phrase it, countries are dealing with their own problems right now. And that gets me to the second point, where internationally, the organizations that we would usually see as taking a lead against combating coups, there've been suggestions that they're not condemning these events as much as they would have in the past. And that goes into what the Secretary General had previously been claiming, But there is this question as to whether or not maybe a few of these early recent coups sent a signal to individuals in other countries that this was something that they could do and be able to get away with.
Clayton, I think there's an assumption that coups are undemocratic and will lead to undemocratic governance. Is it a fair assumption that, you know, coups, I mean, certainly as an institution, they're undemocratic, particularly if they're overthrowing a democratic government, but is this leading to governments that aren't democratic?
In the vast majority of cases, yes. I mean, the vast majority of cases, what you have is an authoritarian regime being replaced by another authoritarian regime. So John and I have Dr. Powell and I have a previous article that does show that there is a positive correlation between coups and democratization. So when you compare cases of when you look at the whole world, coups can open a window of opportunity. And so if we think about like Egypt in the absence of a coup, has no prayer at democracy, right? Now it ended up not having democracy, but at least had a prayer. But to say that coups are good for democracy is not right. To say that they give you a prayer in situations where you otherwise wouldn't have had that prayer is right. Right. They can open that window of opportunity, but certainly even, you know, as one of the people that published on this saying that coups can open that window of opportunity, I'm still pessimistic about coups. Like that it's very rare that they are a good thing, but they can be.
I realize we kind of jumped into this conversation, Joseph, without, first of all, good definition of what a coup actually is. And certainly the image we have in our mind are civilians being overthrown by the military. Is that commonly what coups are, or is that an essential component of what coups are?
Yeah, so there's some the folks who collect data on this, like my colleagues on the panel, for example, and we have to sort through the cases of what is a coup and what is not. But I would bet that 99% of the time we agree on what a coup is and what isn't. And generally, there's the participation of the military. Now, there's lots of folks who have used the word coup that have some sort of adjective associated with it, like in a presidential coup or an incumbent-led coup or something like that. But generally, when I use the term coup or in the research that I've conducted, we mean the military. Some member of the internal security force or the military is using weapons or the threat of using weapons to oust an incumbent leader of a country or the prospective leader of a country. So there are a handful of cases where someone's elected president and then they're sort of ousted before they take power. You know, in the US, we have, I don't know how many weeks before November election and a January inauguration, but that's sort of this period where a prospective election winner could be ousted. But generally, it's targeting an attempt to oust incumbents and replace them with somebody else. And so, yeah, so I usually consider it to be something that involves the military and the threat or use of force and generally unconstitutional. I'm not sure that there's any constitution that says that it's constitutional for the military to say, yes, we're going to threaten to oust the incumbent. So this idea of it being unconstitutional is there as well.
Now, Fabrice, when I initially did research and thinking about these coups, most of the articles highlight the spate of coups in Africa. But of course, historically, when I think of coup d'etats, immediately Latin America also comes to mind. There's this long history of coups within Latin America. And there's definitely some Latin American examples. One that immediately comes to mind, you know, of course, is Haiti. How vulnerable have the governments in Latin America been to coups? First of all, in this recent period, this last, say, 18 to 24 months, and then generally speaking, is Latin America moving towards a post-coup phase? Certainly, you know, in comparison, you know, to the past, are they still very much vulnerable?
If we do a comparison of all parts of the world, and Joseph Wright, Clayton, and Jonathan have put together these very nice global data sets, we can argue about particulars and that sort of thing. But what all the data sets show is Latin America, if you look at between 1945 and 1990, 2000, was by far the most unstable region in the world. The data set that I use goes from 1900, actually the 19th century to the present, and it's even clearer. So I think that's point number one. But to get directly to your question, and that would be point two I would make, would be we've seen the virtual disappearance of coups in Latin America since the 1990s. What's going on? And maybe this is one way we can relate what I've learned and what happens in Latin America and the way what other people have said with what's going on in this recent spate of coups. And what I find in my research is that there are four variables that help us predict, understand when coups happen. Autocratic regimes are much more likely to have coups than democratic regimes for a number of reasons. Of course, time since the last coup. So the longer time, the less likely you have a coup. I also find election years are very predictive of coups. So there's something about an electoral cycle that I think we're now beginning to understand. And then the fourth thing is the post 1991, because in my own work, I find that between 1917 and 1991, the period of the Bolshevik threat, there's not more likely that coups are to happen in, with respect to other periods, and certainly not more in the Cold War than in other periods. But after 1991, there's this dramatic decline in Latin America, and I think in many other parts of the world. So one of the reasons why there've only been, I quickly looked this up before the meeting, there've only been six coups in Latin America since 1990. Three of those are attempts, three of those are attempts that succeed, that is they overthrow the president, is most of these regimes have democratized. It's been a while since there's been a coup. And that factor both tells us a lot and it doesn't tell us very much. We need to think about what does time since the last coup, what does that really mean? And I think the short answer I have for that, it means factionalism. And looking at sub-Saharan Africa, you get a transition in the 90s like in Latin America, but it's not as broad and it's not as deep. You see backsliding in both regions. So we're now seeing the return of some autocratic regimes in Latin America, Nicaragua, Venezuela is the most prominent case, but it's been a while since there's been a coup. And my own research shows if you have an autocracy and it's been a while since you've had a coup, 20, 30 years, you've inoculated your regime, or to use the jargon, the regime is sort of coup-proofed. And I think those would be the things that if we look at the places in the world which have had coups, we don't see those conditions. That Myanmar was a dictatorship. And most of these places in sub-Saharan Africa, and I don't want to say more than I actually know about sub-Saharan Africa, they're not really democratic. And of all the regions of the world, there's been a declining coup since the end of the Cold War in Africa, but that has not been as anywhere near as deep as in the other regions of the world.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the recent trend towards coups with Jonathan Powell of the University of Central Florida, Clayton Tyne of the University of Kentucky, Fabrice Luke of the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, and Joseph Wright of Pennsylvania State University. And Jonathan, what Fabrice just said, one of the predictors as to whether or not a state is going to have a coup is how recent was their previous coup. The presumption here would be that the longer that you have a consolidated democracy, the less vulnerable you are to a coup. Is that a normative question, or is that more of an institutional question that you develop the institutions where there's just political disincentives for coups? Or is it just they're simply not acceptable in certain states the longer the state has been democratic?
I think there are a few things going on. The first thing that I'll point out is that we're going to see the same effect whether it's a dictatorship or a democracy. The further you get removed from your last coup, the more likely the regime is going to be able to avoid future attempts. And if future attempts are made, they're probably going to be more likely to survive them. And there are a few different reasons for this. We can see the growth and development of political institutions in the country. Basically, you build the rules of the game, people learn the rules of the game, and whether, you know, willingly or figuring out they need to do this because of, you know, potential consequences of not playing by the rules, folks start to follow the rules. If we look at on the flip side, and other than looking at what happens as you get more distant from a coup and look at this other idea of once you have a coup, you have much more in the near future. I think we can think of this in a bit of a different way. And there's a lot of different reasons why once you do have a coup, you could have more in the near future. Some of them might be counter-coup attempts that are specifically trying to return the previous regime into power that had been overthrown. Sometimes this can effectively be military infighting, where you have different factions then, you know, seeing a window of opportunity to be able to get their own interests prioritized, end up trying to overthrow the government. And then through a variety of different pressures, both internally and externally, we can see things like the rise of mass protests, you know, the consequences of things like international sanctions. And oftentimes we will see folks within the armed forces effectively veto a coup that had previously happened and overthrow a government and change the trajectory that the original coup leaders would have preferred. So overall, there are a variety of different reasons why distance from a coup is going to help you survive.
Yeah, and when you think of mass mobilizations, Joseph, right? Yeah, think of what's been going on, for instance, in the former Soviet Union, where you start seeing the so-called color revolutions, which sometimes are described, I guess it could be described as coups, or maybe the, you know, the toppling of certain governments. I guess, is there a relationship between mass mobilization of societies and military coups, or do they tend to be kind of an elite versus elite endeavor?
Historically, there are lots of instances we can point to in which upright or mass protests are occurring simultaneously as a coup is happening. Sometimes the origins of both are the same. That is, there are civilian leaders who gin up support for a coup, and they align with military leaders who execute the coup. Certainly, you can think of Chile in the summer of 1973 as being a case where there's lots of anti-Allende mobilization by conservative elite who are aligned with the military. That's become increasingly so, I think, insofar as we see a lot of coups now happening both while there's protests going on, and secondly, they're happening either during election season or sort of in response to the announcement of an election season, which is itself oftentimes a sort of a trigger for social mobilization. Protests. And so one of the difficult things in trying to sort of assess what effect coups or coup attempts have on sort of the trajectory of democracy and democratization is that they happen so often simultaneously with these other events, which we know anti-regime mobilization, for example, is probably the single best predictor of democratization in the last 30 years, in autocracies at least. And so when coups are happening alongside protests, it's hard to distinguish which is doing the work of causing the democracy. You know, and so that's why, you know, I'm the pessimist when it comes to coups and democracy in the room, perhaps. But that's a big reason why. And, you know, the time periods where we see evidence of coups precipitating democracy, or at least democracy that lasts more than a year or two, was really in that early 1990s period, where coups were helpful in sort of displacing long-ruling authoritarian regimes.
Fabrice, you wanted to respond to this as well.
Well, I'll just pick up on two points that we heard. If I heard Jonathan Powell, he seemed to say that whether the regime was democratic or autocratic didn't have much impact on whether there would be a coup. He works with a different data set than I do. He has a global data set. I have one that's very carefully constructed for 18 countries for over 100 years. And I found a very, very different result. So, and I think that's something to say, that some of these very basic questions we're still trying to figure out as a group of researchers. But kind of to this point about whether coups promote democracy, I have to say, I think coups are profoundly anti-democratic. Now, there are cases, for example, I think of Guatemala in 1944, where there were, I believe, two coups, maybe three coups that year. And the first coup overthrows a dictator, Jorge Ubico, General Jorge Ubico, who came to power in another coup in 1931, I believe it was. The regime opened up, but I don't think that there was a coup that year, but to somehow to say that, to trace that to the coup, I think is a little bit too empiricist, because what happens that year is a mobilization of urban Guatemala. And I think that the coups that tend to have maybe some positive benefits for opening the regime are ones There are a bundle of things which include a mass mobilization of society. There's specific conjunctures. And I wonder whether instead of trying to figure out whether we trace it to the coup or to the mass mobilization, we simply say that there's this bundle of factors that are just, yes, there's a coup there. We put it in our coup data sets. But if we're trying to think about the long-term implications, that's a fundamentally different sort of beast than the run-of-the-mill coups, because most coups, especially like the one in Chile in 1973 that Wright mentioned, they're highly destructive of democracy. And coups are constituent of the coup trap, which is profoundly destabilizing for democratic and even for authoritarian regimes.
And Jonathan, you want to respond as well?
Just a quick correction. Earlier, I wasn't saying that there's no difference between democracies and dictatorships in terms of suffering coups. I was saying that this idea of the length of time since you've had a coup attempt is going to be similar across dictatorships and democracies. So I just wanted to make that clarification.
I found something, a different effect, that I found that when you get a transition to democracy, the threat of a coup declines rapidly. Doesn't get to zero, but it falls dramatically. You don't get as much of effect in an authoritarian regime, and it takes much longer for the Tehran regime to become stable for that time since the last coup to have its effect. So the trajectories have very different slopes, but once authoritarian regimes figure out how to ensconce themselves, man, those are highly, sadly, impregnable fortresses.
Clayton, let's bring you as well. I think you have some thoughts on this.
I guess you just kind of said almost what I was going to say. The idea, again, is not that coups are democratic, right? That they're always good things. But to say that they're fundamentally anti-democratic, most of them yield non-democracies. But don't forget, almost all of them happen in authoritarian regimes, right? So most coups are not overthrowing democracies. So they're not democratic, but they're not necessarily, they're just replacing one bad guy with another. And when we're talking about these entrenched hardcore authoritarian regimes, what other option do you have? That's kind of what we're getting at with this. Like, what other option do you have? And so, Dr. Wright, you're absolutely right in terms of they coincide with other things. And this is where I think about like Erica Chenoweth's work, where she's looking at, you know, the influence of protests and what type of protests are effective. She says those protests where the military first says that nonviolent protests are effective, but then she also says when the military defects and joins those protesters, then those protests are more effective. Well, I mean, she's calling military defection. We're calling it a coup, but it's the same thing, right? So because when that coup or when that military is staring down a million people in Tahrir Square, right? They can either shoot at them or they can join them, right? But there does come a time when the domestic turmoil is so high that they've got to make a decision. And that decision sometimes is to side with those protesters and oust the leaders. And that's where we can get these unique, really nice situations where democracy has a breath of a chance, where if the military took the other option and unloaded their weapons on those protesters, democracy has no chance. Right. We're just in the long standing authoritarian regime that was there in the first place.
And Joseph Wright, your response.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember when we're looking at discussing whether coups are sort of helpful for democratization is that a lot of our evidence for that in these windows is that the coups oftentimes will produce elections. And those elections oftentimes yield civilian leaders. But there's a reason why oftentimes, particularly with professionalized militaries like you might see in Sudan or Myanmar, is that they're willing to give up power to a civilian precisely because they don't give up all the power and they retain their capacity to re-intervene should they not get what they want from the civilian leaders. And that certainly is helpful in explaining what happened in Sudan and Myanmar. In fact, while we can talk about the civilian prime ministers in those two instances that were ousted by the military, nonetheless, those were very constrained democracies because the military effectively had veto power over lots and lots of things that those civilians did when they were trying to run the government. And so while there can be elections and those elections can yield ostensible civilian leaders, oftentimes the democracies that they do yield aren't so good. You know, other good examples that I'm sure Fabrice is quite familiar with would be in Central America in the 1980s. There were a series of elections that they yielded civilian leaders, but the military retained, you know, like Latin Americans call it tutelary power. They had power over lots of things and restricted what the civilians could do. And that's sort of a that's sort of qualitatively, even if we call it a democracy, because there's a civilian leader and there's an election, it's certainly not what we want in a democracy.
That's a reminder that political scientists don't see democracies as a dichotomy, but instead as a bit of a continuum, raising the broad question, are coups directed at democracies or at authoritarian regimes? A number of these countries would be described as democracies because they've held an election, but institutionally don't necessarily look like democracies.
When we come back, how much is the rise of military coups threatened the world's democracies? How concerned should we be? Stay with us. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Regional organizations and powerful states have sometimes played important roles in averting takeovers by military coups. How successful have they been? How can they be improved? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're discussing the recent trend, the recent spate of coups, notably in sub-Saharan Africa, but numerous examples from all over the world. Our guests today are Jonathan Powell, associate professor at the University of Central Florida, Clayton Tyne, department chair and professor in the political science department at the University of Kentucky, Fabrice Luke, professor in the department of political science at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, and Joseph Wright, professor in the department of political science at Pennsylvania State University. Clayton Tyne, I know you've done work on external actors and the role that they've played in coups. How much is this recent trend driven by external variables, including there's been a great deal of discourse about whether or not democratic governments are as committed to democracy abroad in the last few years as they had been previously? Is this an external question, or is it really primarily an internal question, whether or not we're seeing these coups?
Primarily, I do think it's an internal question, but I'll answer the external part. And part of this is going to replicate a little bit what we heard earlier from Dr. Powell. But the norm of, and I do think it's a norm nowadays, of hammering coups is a good one. And it's something that we've seen from states like the United States and organizations like the OAS and the African Union have been better than one would expect, I think, in expressing displeasure and actually having some teeth to that displeasure when a coup happens. What we've seen is COVID. And with COVID, it's really hard to convince anybody that we should care about a coup somewhere else, right? These aren't even making the news, right? Or very few of them are making the news. I have to tell my students about these. And so when you've got thousands of people dying per day, to use bandwidth to punish a coup leader, you're just not going to do it. So I do think COVID's a big part of the story. So I think the external actors, let me broaden it a little bit back in time. The external actors, I think, is your primary reason why we've seen coups plummet since the end of the Cold War. I mean, that's your best causal explanation, is that all of a sudden we stopped the pressure from the Soviets, and we have regional organizations and even international organizations that can have more teeth and more bandwidth to even pay attention to this sort of stuff. So we see these organizations develop in their capacity and the teeth and the consistency at which they punish coup leaders and juntas. And I think that's why we've seen plummet. But the recent spike, I hate saying that everything's due to COVID, but a lot of the stuff's due to COVID, I think.
And Fabrice, in Latin America in particular, if you think about external actors, clearly, whenever you talk about Latin America, we're going to talk about the United States, you know, playing a role. I'm also curious about other regional actors. I know in the Southern Cone, for example, Brazil, who had had several coups, has been remarkably stable and democratic recently. And so is the reason why Latin America has been much less prone to coup, is this mostly an internal question, or how much do external actors play a role in this?
I would agree with Clayton Thine that it's mostly internal. And let me start off by reminding of something. When we think of Latin America, and that was in your question, we think of Uncle Sam sponsoring regime overthrows. And there's certainly no question that throughout major parts of the 20th century, 19th, the United States favored non-democratic coalitions, and that had a negative effect on democracy in the region. However, one of the things I did in my database was to try to get information on how many coups had some sort of involvement for the United States. And what I find is it's incredibly small, that we tend to focus on what happens in Guatemala in 1954, where arguably, if it wasn't for CIA involvement, Arbenz's regime wouldn't have fallen. And then the left tends to point to Chile in 73, but I think that regime was going to fall anyway. There was an internal class struggle, which had become this titanic struggle between the executive and the legislature. The U.S. role, we can condemn it on normative grounds. I certainly would, but it doesn't have much of an impact. So I think the role of the United States is being really overemphasized in Latin America. Now, that said, and even I would must say in the 20th century, there were occasions where the United States actually played a role to prevent a dictatorship from stabilizing. You know, Costa Rica, 1917, the defense minister, Tinoco, overthrows the elected president, Alfredo Gonzalez, the Wilson government refuses to recognize that new regime, which means they can't get bank loans in the middle of Costa Rica's export markets of coffee to the Germany being closed because of World War I. That U.S. role played a part in bringing down that regime. I don't want to say it was the major cause, but we often forget the cases where, and there were some cases where the United States actually helped democracy. And certainly in the third wave, U.S. policy became more supportive. But the thing that I want to point out is, I think the reason why for Latin America, you get such a dramatic decline in coup activity after, with the end of the Cold War. And again, the Cold War, that period in time is now more likely to have more coups than other periods in Latin America. I want to emphasize that. But 1991, the end of the Soviet Union, there we go. The end of the Soviet Union is because the 1980s was in Latin America a period of no economic growth, actually a period of economic catastrophe. And military regimes were in charge. And many of these regimes relinquished for a variety of reasons, basically to give it to the civilians to solve these very difficult, basically shifting terms of trade problems. That was at the root cause of the shifting economic fortunes. But a number of those military regimes were actually defeated on the streets. So we think of Argentina in the 1980s, where the Argentine junta invades the Falklands. Margaret Thatcher decides she's not going to allow this and actually prevails. I thought it was easy for Great Britain to win. Actually, if you look at the period, it wasn't so clear that the Brits were going to beat the Argentines. Well, they win, that humiliates the junta. And what you see happen throughout Latin America is the combination of economic crisis and political crisis liquidates the military. It allows the newly elected democratic officials to purge the military of all those elements that had submerged the region in the coup trap for decades, really since the beginning of the 20th century. The 19th century in Latin America is about civil war. The 20th century, there are civil wars and revolution, but it's really the 20th century is about the military coup d'etat. So I would say that it's, yes, the United States and the OAS playing a role in not recognizing illegitimate governments, in encouraging democratization. I don't want to underestimate that. But the fundamental fact, the fundamental cause, I think, in Latin America was you got a political alignment and the military is skewered, it's purged. And that's made such a difference.
Joseph Wright, you had a response as well.
Just a real quick note on a couple of recent post-Cold War coup attempts in Latin America. The OAS basically gave the green light to a coup attempt in Venezuela in 2002, and they did it again in 2019 in Bolivia. They basically ratified allegations of fraud in an election that turned out not to be true. And so, you know, I just wanted to add that there are two anecdotes where the OAS clearly took the side of the coup makers for ideological reasons because they're aligned with the U.S. administration at the time.
Although, Joseph, just a quick follow-up, very important point with the OAS, but Mercosur, my understanding, kind of might have served as a, you know, a counterweight to that. And I know the accusation is that the OAS is really pretty dominated by the United States, whereas Mercosur, I mean, Brazil plays a much larger role. Is my understanding correct on that?
Yes.
Very good. Yeah, Clayton, please.
Yeah, I mean, Joe or Dr. Wright, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think there's a broader point to be attached to what he said, and that is that the regional IGOs, whether you're talking about OAS or AU, have a lot of work to do, right? Have a lot of work to do. So I did paint them in a very positive light. And I think that's true given where they started. But I mean, the AU, right? It was, you know, crafted by people who came to power via coups, right? I mean, these are the people that led it. So for them to all of a sudden say that we're going to consistently hammer on coups, given where they started, I'm impressed. I'll say that. But to look at it with a critical eye, like Dr. Wright just did, I think is also astute.
And Jonathan Powell, on this issue of external actors here, another one immediately comes to mind. After the coup in Myanmar, the general consensus was the U.S., the EU, really, we're not going to play the lead role in trying to counter that coup. It was the regional organization, ASEAN. They don't seem to have a terribly good record at this point in addressing the coup in Myanmar. So is it fair to say, even if the organizations tend to be more regional, there's some promise there, but really not that much success at trying to counter coups?
I think regional organizations can play an important role. In the case of ASEAN, they've got a serious problem in which they don't actually have any sort of an anti-coup framework. So if we're taking like a legalistic approach to this, you know, as a formality, there's nothing the organization itself can really do aside from, you know, call emergency meetings and bring heads of state and interested parties together to discuss these things. They don't have a formal set up like the African Union does with suspending member states and the like. But looking beyond ASEAN, looking at some of these organizations that do have these sorts of frameworks, and I think this gets back to the point that Dr. Wright was making earlier, these organizations can have an important and positive impact, but they really need to stay committed to trying to prevent coups. So, you know, so as Dr. Wright was bringing up, if you are turning a blind eye, you know, in some cases, or even buying into false narratives in others in the sense of, you know, portraying an election as being fraudulent or other issues that might be out there, that's going to undermine whatever gains you might have made. And in the case of Latin America in particular, I think Latin America's, the responses we saw in Latin America to coups, especially in the post-Cold War period, can kind of serve as an ideal as to what might be possible to sending very clear signals that these things aren't going to be tolerated anymore. So if we look at the coup in 91, I think it was in Haiti under Raul Cedras, the response was universal condemnation from the Western Hemisphere. They were slapped with very serious trade embargoes, weapons embargoes, and everything. And there really wasn't anything the junta could do. And they managed to last a few years before finally stepping down. But this would send a very clear signal to other folks that might try these sorts of things in the region that this sort of activity isn't going to be tolerated. And then move forward a few years, there was a coup attempt in January 2000 in Ecuador, where you had a Colonel Lucio Gutierrez temporarily overthrow the government. Well, temporarily in the sense that he was soon pushed out, but the president didn't come back into power either. So we can argue about what a successful coup actually looks like. And that gets even more difficult than the coup question itself. But One of the reasons why the coup in 2000 in Ecuador fell apart was the folks in the military high command literally said they're going to make us look like Cuba in terms of economic isolation, and we're not going to be able to survive this. So the coup leader ends up in jail, at least for a few months. He ended up running for election and coming in through the legitimate means shortly thereafter. But if we look at what's going on in Africa, we see these similarly mixed responses. In some cases, you see the region give very explicit condemnation, and in the early years of Africa's framework, it looked like it maybe was going to start following those really harsh responses that the OAS had had. And even before the launch of the African Union in 2002, this really started in 97 with a coup in Sierra Leone against a democratically elected government, heavy condemnation from the region, the Economic Community of West African States Monitoring Group, mainly Nigeria, Nigerian forces militarily intervene and push out the junta and restore the fallen leader. Fast forward a few years, the AU comes into power. It is much more explicit in its condemnation of coups. It has a much more explicit framework for dealing with coups. And the first coup that it had to deal with, we saw a similar response. Now, granted, it was the tiny country of Sao Tome and Principe, but we saw a similar outcome where there was a direct threat of military intervention, and the coup leaders didn't last 2 weeks. They very quickly stepped down. Unfortunately, that was the last time, if I'm remembering correctly, that was the last time in Africa that a deposed leader or leader deposed through a coup was actually reinstated specifically due to an international response. So the African Union and ECOWAS itself, they've both been credited for being committed to an anti-coup norm, but they've been committed to this in the sense that they will condemn the coup. They will usually, almost exclusively, they're going to suspend membership in their organizations. But coup leaders at this point have learned that the penalties they're going to suffer are going to end as soon as they suffer or as soon as they allow an election, regardless of the coup leaders or other coup participants themselves are actually contesting those elections. So I can stop talking there. There are a few more points I could develop on that. But all that is to say is I think these organizations do have an immense opportunity to shape the future of coup activity in their regions, but they really have to remain committed to it and make it very clear that they're going to follow through on their obligations.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle. We're discussing international responses to the recent trend for coups and placing them in the historical context with Jonathan Powell of the University of Central Florida, Clayton Tyne of the University of Kentucky, Fabrice Luke of the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, and Joseph Wright of Pennsylvania State University. And Joseph Wright, kind of this recent trend in Africa, have there been much of a response from the AU, from the African Union, or from some of the regional organizations with these coups? Has there been a desire, an attempt to try to politically isolate these post-coup governments, or has the response been, you know, kind of muted?
So I'm going to defer to my colleagues on that because I haven't followed all the cases as well as I probably should have. How I'll respond rather is sort of theoretically, and this gets back to points that my colleagues have made earlier too, is that it's easier for Western organizations or Western-backed organizations, Western states to exert pressure, particularly in the form of economic pressure, when the country in question does not have, or the coup makers do not have a ready-made ally in a non-Western group. And that's what makes the 1990s kind of a unique period where there's not another potential player out there that can counter Western pressure. And not only do you have Chinese pressure, economic pressure in some countries in Africa that can give regimes a lifeline. And the Chinese government appears to not be concerned whatsoever about coups. And then secondly, you've seen a slight uptick, I would say, of increased Russian military presence and their what you call their private military organizations. But you see an uptick in that. And so if that changes the international environment to such an extent that even if the regional organizations want to exert pressure or the West wants to exert pressure, and they do follow through, then there's going to be limitations to that, just like there were during the Cold War.
Jonathan Powell, I'll first of all, ask that question, what has the response generally been? I think Joseph Wright raises an interesting point about the impact of China. In an observation, President Biden has declared one of the foreign policy goals is a restoration of democracy and trying to address these concerns about democracy. I read that and immediately think, you know, Central Europe seems to be where he's directed. But has the U.S. actually changed policy in places like sub-Saharan Africa?
Since the 1980s, the U.S. has at least had a policy that in theory should act in a similar manner as these regional organizations' frameworks for trying to prevent coups, in the sense that if you do have a coup against at least a duly elected government, that the United States is supposed to cut off various forms of assistance, particularly military assistance. Unfortunately, they have basically not necessarily followed the lead, but they're in lockstep with what these regional organizations are doing. Whereas so long as you do have a subsequent election, and so long as it's at least marginally free and fair, regardless of the participation of the coup plotters or coupists broadly construed, even if those folks participate in it, you can expect that soon after aid dollars are going to start coming back, weapons transfers can start coming back. So I think the United States finds itself in a similar position as the regional organizations, where they might have a stick that they could potentially use to try to prevent coups from occurring and sending a signal that if a coup does occur, we're not going to, you know, provide patronage to your armed forces in the future. But they're not really using that. And I think ultimately at this point, there's been enough coups and the response has been consistent enough to where anyone who's potentially interested in having a coup realizes that they can follow this, you know, really well-scripted progression at this point, where you have, you know, you basically sit in the penalty box for a little bit, you know, or get yellow carded, and then you're going to have an election, and then you might be able to come back. If not in the first election, we've seen a tendency to come back very soon after that first election across the board.
And Joseph Wright?
Yeah, real quick, just to piggyback there, let's not forget the so-called war on terror is still in progress. Dr. Powell's colleague has a great explanation, I think, for what went on in Pakistan, you know, absorbs massive amounts of U.S. foreign aid, and always saying there's this threat of terrorism, right? So some of that might be going on in the Sahel, where there's this overriding security concern, supposedly, from the U.S. Policymakers, such that they're less concerned about coups and more concerned about making sure access and dollars flow to fight a so-called war on terror there.
And Clayton, that kind of raises a broader issue, and I've been thinking about this since the comments on COVID, that how much is the emphasis broadly less on the process of democratization and more sort of generally on just, shall we say, government competence, that one of the reasons why COVID certainly could be leading to coups, there's a general discontent with governments anyway because of COVID, and definitely because the stakes have been raised so high, a sense, a lack of patience with governments that are perceived to not be terribly competent in dealing with those challenges. That's at least one of the justifications with the global war on terror, though that's very much a simplified version of what that issue could be. So is the fact that we're expecting the governments to do so much more means that increasingly actors are saying, I care more about competence than about process? Or am I overstating this, you know, potential threat, you know, to the idea of democratic norms?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. It's a good question. Actually, you know, Dr. Wright is a leading comparativist, might have a better handle on this. So go ahead and jump in, Joe, if you want to. But the thing I'm thinking about when I see a coup and I think, okay, if Joe Biden called me into his office and asked me, hey, what should I do? I know this. One, the answer is never that obvious, right? And two, he's got lots of options even under U.S. law, because these coups just so very rarely overthrow democracies. So exactly what John just said, he said that he was actually quoting the U.S. law on this, duly elected regimes, but you have the exact same language, correct me if I'm wrong, John, but in both the OAS and the AU, they don't actually have to do anything if the coup overthrows an authoritarian regime. Right? They only have to do something if they overthrow a democracy. Well, these aren't overthrowing democracies, so they really have all kinds of options on their table. And so, you know, I think a lot of what we're seeing is that when a coup happens, you know, politicians, they don't think that far in advance, right? They're thinking about the next election. They're thinking 2 years in advance. So the choices they're making are about today, right? In the next 2 months or the next 2 years. But what I think really a tone coming from this whole conversation is that by thinking so short term, they're adding inconsistency. And that inconsistency out there, all coup plotters are looking at this inconsistency. And today, if I'm a potential plotter, I'm saying that basically I can take the international community and set it aside, because my prediction is they're not going to say a word, right? Because they've been so inconsistent.
So on the competence issue, I think this is one of the reasons why you're seeing substantial public support for these events in some countries, particularly Mali and Burkina Faso, because the government's not being able to deal with the insurgency and the worsening of insurgency in their countries. It's sending a very clear signal that the governments are flat out ineffective. And to worsen matters, at least in the case of Mali in 2020, everybody viewed their legislative elections as having been rigged. So to the degree that they had been what we might interpret as a democracy, people really didn't respect that at that point anymore. So I think right now it's a bit of dangerous territory in the sense that people are looking for something else. They're looking for something that, to use your word, might be more competent. There might be better governance. And unfortunately, folks right now seem like they might be more interested in entertaining the idea of army rule, which, to be very clear, is likely going to be a disastrously bad idea. But if you look at what survey data, even in Mali, has said recently, where if you look at the most recent wave of Afrobarometer, it's something like 35-40% of the people say having the army rule would be a very good or a good idea. And then if you look at a recent survey that was specifically in Bamako, the capital, it was even vastly higher than that. To me, this is truly extraordinary given what happened in Mali after its brief experience with military rule in 2012, where you had a coup against a longtime civilian government. And then the military junta promptly lost half of the country's territory to an Islamist insurgency. So, you know, in a way, this is a bit bizarre, right? We would think that people would be very wary of army rule, but here we are just 10 years later, and people are far more likely to support it than they would have been in the past.
And Fabrice, it might be because of the area you're researching in Latin America, or broadly, I guess I want to end on a high note, the suggestion that coups are, we're actually decreasing the number of coups and we've got some brighter days ahead. Am I misreading your general interpretation? Should we be as concerned about coups going forward?
Well, I think we should be elated. I think the coup trap, and I think that's, well, it's fine to talk about coups. What I think is fundamental here is political systems mired in instability, where one coup leads another. You get chronic instability, and that's associated with many other things. I think the coup trap is behind us in Latin America. However, I'm not sure if it's going to disappear permanently. So thinking of my research and relating it and kind of making a general sort of forecast is we have mostly democratic regimes in Latin America, which managed to make the transition and purged the military. That's great. So you don't get that rapid succession of coups anymore. But we have seen the reappearance of authoritarian regimes in Latin America. And let's see whether this authoritarianism helps breed the part of the coup coalition, which was civilian opposition working with dissident factions in the military to overthrow incumbents. That could return for some of these countries. Nonetheless, for example, if I think of, and here we have to talk about cases, I'll just mention one, Venezuela. I think this regime has gotten past the point of no return. And I think it's phenomenal to think that a regime that democratized in 58 and became democratic and then backslid and essentially created a dictatorship, I think the relationship between the top and the military is such that you're not going to see that sort of reemergence of the coup trap. But time will tell. It could still happen. But I think the key thing here ultimately is political. If you have an organization, the military and society, which is full of rival factions, and they're part of the political game, and civilians come in and bring them in, if you get rid of that, it's like removing the liquor from the alcoholic's home. He doesn't get drunk anymore.
It's a wonderful place to end. We've been discussing the recent spate of coups, the threats to democracy, external reactions, and whether we should be optimistic or pessimistic about the future of democratization. Our guests today have been Jonathan Powell, Associate Professor at the School of Politics, Security, and International Affairs at the University of Central Florida. He's the author of Strong Men and Straw Men, Appraising Post-Coup Political Developments, and the co-author of Global Instances of Coups from 1950 to 2010, A New Data Set, with his frequent co-contributor, Clayton Tine. Clayton Tine is department chair and professor in the political science department at the University of Kentucky. He is also the co-author of Democratic versus Authoritarian Coups, The Influence of External Actors on States' Post-Coup Political Trajectories. Fabrice Luc, professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. He's the co-author of Breaking Out of the Coup Trap, Political Competition and Military Coups in Latin America and Political Institutions, Instability and Democratic Performance in Latin America, a Research Agenda. And Joseph Wright, professor in the Department of Political Science at Pennsylvania State University and co-director of its Global and International Studies Program. He's the co-author of How Dictatorships Work and a forthcoming historical dictionary of modern coup d'etats. Thank you all very much for joining us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.